his reputation in danger, his screw reputation, to quote. And so basically we want to discuss the basic stuff about quantum theory, quantum mechanics. And we have celebrated 100 years of quantum theory recently. And we could obviously equally well celebrate 100 years of not having quantum gravity, because we don't really understand the connection between gravity and quantum theory. But the problem with quantum theory is that although it gives you perfect predictions up to 10 digits that agrees with experiments, even after 100 years, there are people who claim we don't really understand what's going on. And some people even doubt in quantum theory, some serious people. And this is simply because of very basic postulates that are very unintuitive and not well understood. And I'm not talking about Hilbert spaces or states or unitary operations, etc., because this is all math. But the basic things that are so unnatural to us to embrace is the fact that we have to compute probabilities at all, that reality is not deterministic, that we have to face the fact that nature is undeterministic. We cannot predict the results of experiments. They appear to be spontaneous. We can repeat the same experiment twice. We get two different outcomes. That's one of the things that is so puzzling. The second thing is that you can have systems, when you don't observe them, that behave as if they were in two places at the same time. So it just looks exactly like that. If you had a system here, a system here, and when you don't observe it, it looks as if it was at two places at the same time, which is the second puzzling thing. And people hoping that we could understand it on a deeper level have failed for a long time. And even if you go to string theory, hoping that this is, some people claim this is the ultimate theory of everything, even that theory assumes the quantum structure where you have a basic concept, which is a string that has a probability of dividing into halves, which is a quantum probability. So it already assumes this whole structure of non-deterministic and non-deterministic behavior and superposition principle. So the purpose of this work is to show you that you can actually derive these things from very, very basic concepts. You don't have to assume those things. And we think we have a reason to believe that you can actually derive this from very special idea, namely from special relativity. And the claim of this work is that not only that quantum local and deterministic mode of description is inconsistent with quantum mechanics, which we already know, but local and deterministic mode of description is inconsistent with special relativity. And I'm going to talk about this. And obviously, this is a kind of bold statement. And well, to get it right, you have to be prepared to leave the comfort zone a little bit. So, and go towards the slightly non-orthodox formulation of special relativity. But to get there, let me start with a very basic crash course on special relativity. I want to present you a very simple derivation of Lorentz transformation that is kind of somehow illuminating. And in that derivation, you don't assume constancy of the speed of light, but that actually comes as a consequence. This is a conclusion. And this is not many people know this derivation, but it's really interesting. So we start with the assumption that we are looking for a relation between two coordinate systems, prime and unprimed. One is moving relative to the other with velocity v, the standard thing. And we assume that the transformation has to be linear so that no point is in space-time is preferred. And what we don't know is the coefficients of that transformation, a and b. They somehow depend on velocity, but we don't know how. We can only write the inverse transformation by simply using principle of relativity. It's the same transformation with the inverse speed as an argument. All right, so now we can ask the following. What happens when you observe the origin of the moving frame of reference? That origin is in the resting frame moving with constant velocity v. So it's given by the equation x equals v times t. And as a consequence, you can, if you plug those two in the equations, you can find the relation between b and a. Plug it in, that's the result. You find that the most general transformation that is allowed by principle of relativity involves some unknown coefficients function of v times this. And for time, there is a slightly more complicated expression that involves an unknown function of a. And the purpose of the derivation is to derive a. Now, at this point, all that we can say about a is that it is either a symmetric or antisymmetric function of v, simply because if the resting frame flips the direction of time or direction of space, that has to involve a discrete transformation in the formulas. And since V flips the sign when you change T or X, that means that A has to be either symmetric or antisymmetric, so that only a sign flip appears when you, say, change your clock to the moving, the one that moves backwards. All right, so now the purpose is to find A. We haven't assumed anything but principle of relativity at this stage. And to do that, we will consider three frames of reference, three inertial frames of reference. One is at rest, the prime frame is moving with velocity V1 relative to this one, and the third frame is moving with velocity V2 relative to the primed one. And what we need to do to find the transformation between this guy and this guy is simply to iterate this set of equations. And when you do that, you end up with the following expression. It's complicated, doesn't tell you much. However, there is one very important thing you can notice here. Namely, if you look at the ratio between the coefficient that stands in front of t and the coefficient that stands in front of x, that's a velocity. If you go back one slide back, you see that velocity is a ratio of what stands in front of t over what stands in front of x. So if you do that,
is there a t missing somewhere?
No.
No.
Where? There is a t in here.
Oh, I see.
It's a single equation.
Okay.
So you have to take a ratio of what stands in front of t and what stands in front of x. You get this. That's the standard formula. But now you notice that when you do the inverse transformation, starting from the moving guy, going to the middle guy, and ending up in the resting guy, so just do the inverse, you get the same velocity with the opposite sign, but you have to just flip the role of V1 and V2. And when you do that, you find that this is another equation, you can say, it exists. And then you can compare the two. And that's the end of the derivation. You'll see that just in a second. So you find that if this is equal to this, then those coefficients have to be equal. Here they are. And since on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, you have some functions on velocity, for any velocity V1, any velocity V2, that simply means that this complicated thing has to be a constant. I call this constant K. We obviously don't know what the value of K is. Typically, it's denoted 1 over C squared in special relativity. So you find that as a result of just principle of relativity, you find there must be some sort of constant that's of unknown nature that characterizes that unknown function. And that's the velocity of light, inverse of the square of the velocity of light, really, as we know. So we cannot derive the value of that constant. We find it by making experiments, but it certainly exists. And, well, I said that A has to be either symmetric or antisymmetric. So now we can consider the symmetric case. You plug it in the equation, you solve for A, you find this is the solution. These are the standard Lorentz transformations. And when you consider the antisymmetric case, by the way, this is only well established for V smaller than 1 over square root of K, which is subluminal velocities are allowed. If you consider antisymmetric case, you get these solutions. I already plugged in 1 over C squared instead of K, and they are only well defined for V that are larger than C. And obviously, these are discarded as unphysical. People say they are not physical, so they just don't take them into account. But if you just verify their properties, you find that they satisfy all the conditions you want. They preserve the constancy of the speed of light. So if you have any derivation of special relativity you like, you always have these as a second branch of solutions. You just discard them because they are unphysical. Yes?
Just a small technical question. I was just wondering at which point somehow the non-relativistic limit should obviously also respect the same property.
Yes, because if you take k equal to 0, that's also a solution.
Uh-huh.
So you don't know whether k is positive, 0, or negative.
I thought you said k was the
No. Take k equals 1 over c squared. But I could put it 0, then I get just a Galilean transformation. Right, so what we did is we said, okay, it's like when you have quadratic equation, you have two solutions, you can discard one of them, but suppose you don't do that. Suppose you just, let's see what's going on. Let's see what's going on when we take those into account on an equal footing, don't discard them, just treat them with respect and seriously, see what's going on. And it turns out that laws of causality are being disturbed, as you expect, because it leads to well-known problems with causality when you take into account those observers. But contrary to the well-established opinion, they don't really lead to logical paradoxes within the theory. Instead, they lead to conclusion that you have disturbance of causality, but in a way that is very much like the one that we know from quantum theory. So the claim is that if you take those two into account, you can arrive at something that resembles quantum theory a lot. And I'm not aware of a reason why you should really, a physical reason why you should really discard those solutions, other than saying that there is no matter that would be able to create those observers because they're not tachyons or whatever. But I want to now convince you that if you take those into account, nothing really bad happens. The worst that happens is quantum theory, which we know that is already confirmed. Actually, when you discard them, something bad happens because you end up in special relativity that is in contradiction with observations, because in special relativity you have particles moving along single trajectories and everything is deterministic, which is in contrast with experiments. Okay, so any questions or comments at this stage?
So the second one, is it like flipping by...
This is a hyperbolic rotation for angles smaller than 45 degrees.
Yeah.
This is hyperbolic rotation for larger angles.
Right, so it's...
So in particular,
the same way for three dimensions.
I'm going to go there at the final stage.
Okay.
The 1+1 case is very simple. The 3+1 is much more difficult. But essentially, this is a hyperbolic rotation for angles larger than 45 degrees. For infinitely fast-moving observer, you would have time and space being flipped. Okay, so we have this homework assignment. Find out what's going on when you take those into account. Okay, so let's see. So let us consider a very simple scenario in which, the most fundamental process in physics that you can think of, a decay of a particle into two other particles. And suppose that one of those particles is actually superluminal. So it moves from A to B, is being observed by absorbed by the observer somewhere here. And we will make the following assumption. Let us assume that this emission of a particle was completely deterministic, as we know from classical theory, which means that there is some sort of classical process that's going on inside of this word line that can be under control. And I can pull the trigger controlling that process and release a particle, it goes away. So a well-defined, something that we know from classical situation where we control everything. Now, this observer on the other side is being hit by the particle, and he cannot predict that in advance by just knowing his own past. He's not going to predict that he's about to be hit, simply because, it's obvious, right? There is no reason to deduce that this is about to happen only studying the past word line of B. So for the guy B, it's completely spontaneous that he's being hit by a bullet. Now, there is a frame of reference and a standard non-subluminal frame of reference in which the course of these events is reversed. And in this case, what appeared to be absorption becomes an emission, and what was emission becomes an absorption. And now I would like you to think about the following question. If you observe this process in this frame of reference, you suddenly see emission of a particle that goes from B to A. What caused that emission? Well, you could say the cause is somewhere here in a distant place, perhaps in the future. But if you were asked to interpret that event just studying the past word line of the event B, would you be able to predict the event of emission by just studying the history of the particle B? And since there was no reason to believe that anything here determines that event B, in this frame of reference, the situation is the same, which means that if you only want to study locally the properties of the particle B, you won't be able to predict that emission by just local measurements. Non-local, yes, but not local. So there is no local and deterministic way of determining this emission here. So this appears completely spontaneous if you just observe particle B in this frame of reference.
Can you elaborate on what you mean by this frame of reference, which is this frame?
So if this is a rest frame of reference, then there exists a frame that is moving with constant velocity that reverses the events, because these are space-like separated, so you can change the time ordering. Yeah.
So doesn't this assume that superluminal absorption can be distinguished from superluminal emission, right? In the first one, you're saying there isn't any way to do it, but what if for some reason the thing on the left, B absorbing a superluminal particle, is indistinguishable from B emitting a superluminal
particle? I'm only saying that there is this diagram that there is one particle, then there are two particles, and then one goes away. And I assume that there is a reason for this emission here, that there is some hidden variable process that governs this.
Yeah, I'm
not saying anything else.
But I could say it about the other way around.
You're sure.
So one
exactly.
Way of solving it.
Exactly. That's why this is the next step. So since that way of looking at things simply makes these two frames of reference different, because in this one you have deterministic mode description, this one you don't, if you want to keep principle of relativity valid, which says no frame of reference is preferred, then you have to discard the deterministic mode of the description in this frame of reference. And you end up in observation that if you want to keep those superluminal particles and you want them to be emitted by matter, they have to be emitted completely spontaneously with no local deterministic mode of the description in any frame of reference. And since this is a process that is completely spontaneous, that is not deterministic, I can't really send signals with those particles, because to send a signal, to send a message, I have to be able to control the source,
yeah.
Right? And I can't.
Isn't there a loophole in the argument that there could be a common cause for A and B? So you have a hidden variable that determines when A is going to be emitted, but the same hidden variable that is stays somewhere
could
in
be.
The common past is also determining where...
Could be. So I'm assuming that those are separated, they don't know anything about each other, right? So if you... But if you assume common codes for everything, yeah.
You don't have any free choices, and this is all deterministic. So it doesn't mean that if I know a little bit of this deterministic function that governs the whole process on the A branch, I can then find it what is in the B branch. But then it's obviously that if I know on the B branch, I can find it on the A branch. I don't see why there is a difference. If there is no free choices, if everything is deterministically, then I know a little bit of an analytical function, like you know, everywhere, distant places.
I don't know if I understood your question. Well, so I'm just saying this. If the absorption of this particle is completely unpredictable by the guy only watching it himself,
yes,
then this is going to be as unpredictable in this frame when this is an emission. So that emission is like you have an emission of a photon from the atom. It's spontaneous.
Yes, but does it mean that this is unpredictable in the A?
Well, then I started with the assumption that there's a deterministic mode description here.
Yeah.
I end up in this frame to find that there is no deterministic mode description here, which means that if I want everything to be symmetric, I have to abandon the first assumption.
So I would say it's unpredictable if there is a chance in A not to fire. Then it's unpredictable. I don't know whether A will fire or not fire, and therefore I cannot predict. But you somehow do not discuss this. You say fires always.
What I'm saying that if that event happens, there is no way of predicting it. I'm not saying that event has to happen, right? There is a difference.
Just to understand, is the metric that if B does not know,
yeah.
B does not know.
Yes, exactly.
But why should it be?
Because there is principle of relativity and says that both observers have to be equivalent. There should be no preferred observer. That's the principle of relativity.
I know something you don't know.
But it's the same situation viewed from different frames of reference. It's the same situation, only two different observers. And description of events should be the same in both inertial frames of reference. It's the same situation.
Like by the engine that we drew an apparatus that actually knows and conditionally on something happening fires the particle in A. If I write that same thing in the other reference frame, I will still have a little bit of difference, which is this apparatus.
So imagine a situation when those are elementary particles, they are identical. Okay? This is what I'm really describing.
Okay.
Elementary particles. And in that case, this situation and this situation is physically really the same situation. So there should be no preferred scenario. But this is just the beginning. Let me consider what happens when you have massive particles, just a standard situation with no superluminal particles. You have a decay of particles that appears to be normal and something that we are used to. But if you observe that very situation from the infinitely fast frame of reference, the second branch of solutions, the time and space become slipped. That's the transformation you have to apply. And simply you have to rotate the diagram by 90 degrees. And what appeared to you to be subluminal becomes superluminal in the superluminal frame of reference. So in 1+1 dimension, actually, the situation is perfectly symmetric. Massive particles appear to be tachyons for the superluminal observers, and for us, I mean, and vice versa, right? What we consider to be a tachyon for them is a massive particle. So there is a perfect symmetry between those branches of observers in 1+1 dimensional case. In 3+1, it becomes more complicated, but 1+1 is quite simple. So there's a perfect symmetry, and being superluminal actually becomes a relative concept. Right. So since this situation looks like this, it only involves tachyons, and since we already shown that if you have emission of a tachyon, it cannot be described in a local deterministic notion, then this process has to be completely spontaneous as well. And since presence or absence of local deterministic model description cannot be a matter of choice of frame of reference, this has to also be completely spontaneous. So based on that argument, you could say that not only emission of a tachyon has to be spontaneous and non-deterministic, but if you allow superluminal observers to be taken into account, all types of decays cannot be described with a local deterministic model description. Yeah.
I may just be rephrasing Chancellor's question here. I think it's connected, but I'm not really seeing why can't we restore symmetry by assuming that everything is predetermined, written in God's book at the Big Bang?
That we can.
So that is
okay. Yes, that we can. That is always a solution. Like in the quantum theory, right? You can have a super determinism and it's still fine. Right? You can explain all violations of Bell's inequalities by saying it has been predetermined by whatever.
Yeah, I have probably also a related question. Is it at any point in space-time possible to know that this happens? Like this emission of a particle that you talk about, the tachyon. Like after it happens, can I know that it was emitted?
I don't know. I'm not discussing this yet. Mm-hmm. Maybe not, but let me... It's a longer discussion, but... Just let me make another point, and then this is a longer discussion. Yeah.
So what stops me from rotating it all the way around so past and future become interchanged?
Nothing. But in this formulation, you don't, well, in special relativity, there is no preferred direction of time, right? So in principle, all the equations are, you can flip them around, nothing happens. It's symmetric.
Well, except we have a notion of initial and final conditions.
We don't know where that's initial. And we have no idea where does it come from, not from the equations. I'm discussing equations of special relativity. But I agree, the arrow of time, I don't know where it comes from. Not from special relativity, definitely.
So, I mean, you, if I understand you right, you're saying there's no reason to reject the symmetric, the anti-symmetric solution relative to symmetric. It leads you to this, which means you can't say the one on the left is deterministic.
Yeah.
But then it seems it also doesn't have an arrow of time.
Yeah.
Whereas in the usual case, I can at least impose
yeah.
one.
So I can't justify those arrows. That's what
yeah.
you're saying. You're right.
That's right.
Yeah, I can't.
You can't justify.
I should erase them, actually.
Okay.
That's great. Okay, but this is just the beginning. So that shows you that if you take into account superluminal point of view, superluminal family of observers, you will not be able to keep the local and deterministic mode of description. Eventually, I mean, you have to abandon that. That's inevitable. What's next? Let us consider, again, a very standard situation in which a resting observer, subluminal observer, observes light being emitted from A, being reflected from a mirror, and going back to B, standard situation. And let me say something that is kind of trivial. If I place two detectors on the path of the particle, of the photon, if this first detector placed here clicks, absorbing the particle, the second detector will not click. If the second detector clicks, because it absorbed the particle, the first detector could not have clicked because there is just one photon, right? Nothing controversial here. But let me view the same situation from the perspective of the infinitely fast-moving observer. The same thing, just rotated 90 degrees. And appears to me, time goes up, that the mirror is a source of two pair of photons, one going to the left, one going to the right. And there are two indistinguishable paths. However, if I place two detectors, only one of those detectors will click, not two. But if I take detectors away, I have two paths, not one. So if we don't call that the Mach-Zehnder interferometer, then I don't know what we really call it.
Zehnder, you have to recombine it.
Yeah. That's what I'm going to do next. So again, if you take into account superluminal observers, if you just don't discard that possibility, just take that into account, and consider any trivial scenario, like a reflection of light from a mirror or anything else, you end up inevitably in a situation where things behave, photons behave, as if they were at two places at the same time. It's not two photons, it's one photon, because when you place two detectors, only one is going to click. So you inevitably end up in a situation where particles move at the same time along two trajectories. Yep.
So in the lab, sometimes we have that superposition case, and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we know that the particle is doing something boring.
Yeah.
So
you have to change the condition of the experiment, right? You have to change the condition of the experiment.
So but your description doesn't tell me whether I'm expecting to see a superposition or not.
So that becomes relative. So even if you start with a single path in your experiment, there is an observer, in this case, superluminally moving observer, for which your experiment appears to be completely different. It appears to involve superpositions.
Yeah, but I know that sometimes in my lab, I can see the superposition without needing to be moving.
Yeah, so perhaps for an infinitely fast-moving observer, in that experiment there is no superposition at all. Because this is your experiment, and I can go to another frame in which it's an very orthodox situation where just a single path.
So how do you deal with energy conservation?
Oh, that's a really interesting topic. So I would have to go into that for long. I don't have enough time, but there is a very interesting property of superluminal particles. You can develop the whole theory of relativity for them. And for instance, when you have a massive particle and that decays into two other particles, when this has a mass m and this has mass m1 and m2, then m1 cannot be equal to m. So it is not possible to have a situation in which mass of a particle does not change. For tachyon, this is possible. So you can have emission of a tachyon without changing the mass of the source, simply because for massive particles, when you accelerate them, you need more and more energy to reach the speed of light, while for the tachyons, you have to put in more and more energy to slow them down. So you cannot slow down a tachyon below the speed of light because that involves infinite energy. So there is some sort of a symmetry. Energy for a tachyon is something, some details. It's given by this expression.
Andrew, you have 10 minutes.
Yeah, so let me just briefly go to the final stage of what I want to say. So then you can iterate the idea of having more and more paths. For instance, if you consider a situation where a single path transforms into superposition of two of them, then if you go to a frame of reference that moves infinitely fast, you have then three paths, etc. You can iterate more and more. So what I'm saying is that you cannot escape from the notion of having many paths characterizing a single particle. So let us consider the following situation. Let us consider a situation in which a particle leaves the point A, reaches the point B, and moves along multiple paths. And let us ask the following question. How can we describe this diagram using relativistically invariant language? So I want to find some sort of a theory that describes this process. I don't even know what notions in the theory I'm looking for, but I'm asking what are the quantities that are relativistically invariant that characterize such a diagram. So for a single path, the answer is very simple. For a single path, the simplest relativistic invariant that characterizes the path is the proper time along the path. And so it appears that the proper time is exactly the same as this integral, where E and P are given by the standard expressions. So what you know from non-relativistic quantum theory, the phase is nothing more but a relativistic invariant along the path. It's the product of the four momentum and the four position. It's an invariant. It's just a proper time, up to a constant, obviously, that we don't know. So for a single path, that's my relativistic invariant that characterizes the path. If I have multiple paths, then my relativistic invariant quantities that characterize those paths have to be functions of phases along individual paths, which means that I'm going to consider some sort of function that only depends on the relativistic invariance. If I have n paths, then there's going to be n arguments. And I will assume that no labeling plays a role in those invariants. So I will say that the function has to be completely symmetric, and only those completely symmetric functions will interest me because they are relativistic invariants and they don't prefer any labeling. Second of all, I want my quantity to be time invariant, so I don't want to have any preferred direction of time in my theory, which means that when I flip time, that reverses the phase into the opposite one, which means that if I flip all the phases, I have to have the same thing. And I want to assume something else. I want to make the third assumption, which is best understood when you look at this special case of the multiple trajectory scenario. Namely, suppose that when the particle moves from A to B, all the paths cross at a single point. And what I'm looking for is some sort of description of that diagram. And since my theory is not probabilistic, not deterministic, I would like my unknown function that characterizes this to have some properties of probability. Now, I don't know what properties of probability are the good ones, which are not, but there are some very basic properties of probability that are valid in both quantum and classical theory. Namely, when you have composition of two processes following each other, the probability of the whole thing is the product of probabilities. So I want to say that the invariant function I'm looking for has to be composed as a product of function for this part and for that part, which gives me the third condition, which says that the product of the parts for the first, the bottom part, and the upper part has to be function of the whole thing, which involves sum of phases because the particle, the phase is additive. And what I'm saying is that if you take these three conditions and look what are the possible solutions, the number of solutions is very limited. There is a very few solutions that satisfy those three conditions. And the simplest one is this one, where your unknown function involves sum over all paths with exponential functions, with arbitrary constant alpha here, arbitrary constant function beta here, and arbitrary constant gamma here. Three constants, and this is a good solution to all those postulates. This is a special solution, and general solution is a product of the special solutions. This we can prove. Which means that if you're looking for any relativistically invariant theory in characterizing multiple paths, this is the only option that you have. So any relativistically invariant quantities that characterize your theory must involve these types of functions. And for finite number of paths, this is always a finite number. But when you consider infinitely many paths, which you can, then if you want your invariant to be finite and not zero, then alpha cannot be a real number. Only when alpha is purely imaginary, your invariant stays finite and non-zero, even when you have infinitely many paths. So that leads to the conclusion that if you want to consider a scenario in which you have infinitely many paths, then the only reasonable relativistically invariant functions that characterize that involve, well, simply superposing complex probability amplitudes, that we call it. How much time do I have?
So you have, including questions, 4 minutes. So
that's very convenient, because maybe I'll skip this part. It's a bit more complicated. But we better discuss.
Thank you. Questions?
This therefore derives non-relativistic quantum mechanics also.
Well, in this formulation, there is no such thing as non-relativistic quantum mechanics.
There was no.
I mean, you can make a non-relativistic approximation to the dynamical equation characterizing the theory, but the fact that you have non-determinism and principle of superposition is the same in both relativistic and non-relativistic situations. So, to my understanding, there is no such thing as non-relativistic quantum field.
According to the, what you presented,
yes.
According
to what
language, you know,
yes.
I mean,
yes.
So in some sense, but would you not? Is this not some kind of conflict? The fact that the dynamical equations don't look relativistic invariants in the non.
Oh no, they do. Oh, they do. They do. They do. Because if you have this expression, from this you can easily derive Klein-Gödel equation or Dirac equation, whatever. Any relative. If you have the dynamics, because there is a dynamics here, there is time and space. So from the solutions of the dynamical equations, you can find the equations themselves, and they have relativistic forms, could either whether they're Dirac or Klein-Gödel equation, from which you can take the non-relativistic limit, and then you get Schrödinger equation.
There's lots of questions, but I think Tim was first, then Rob, then Justin.
It's an interesting notion that in order to make one way of having the observers, the superluminal observer and the non-superluminal observer, agree on what's going on is to have it non-deterministic. But I mean, they don't have to necessarily. I mean, in relativity, you don't have to agree on how things are happening. You just have to agree on what happens.
Yes.
So I mean, is it really inconsistent for one observer to say, you know, the effect,
yes,
the cause came before the effect, and
it is inconsistent for the following reason. Take this situation. Suppose that you have deterministic description. So there are some gears and wheels that turn here, some chemical processes that take physical place, and they control the emission of that particle. Now, if you go to that frame.
It's a fundamental particle, so there aren't gears and things.
But whatever happens, right? If you have some internal description, like some hidden parameter or visible parameter, whatever, then it cannot just disappear because you start to move. That process cannot just disappear.
No, right? I'm saying it's disappearing. It's just that the interpretation is different. In the first case, what's happening at A causes what happens at B. In the other case, it's sort of backwards.
Yeah, but my understanding of the hidden local theory is that there is some sort of mechanism that there is character, it's characterized by parameter lambda, but there is some physics behind it that we haven't discovered yet. That's the idea of Bell's inequalities. There is some unknown mechanism that we denote by lambda, right? So it's something physical, and it cannot just disappear because you move.
Yeah, but we've already discussed the fact that everything's time symmetric. So if I just interpret it as now I'm watching the film go backwards, but I see all the things happen just the same.
Yes.
Then what's wrong with that?
But physical equations are predictable in both ways, right? You can predict the future, you can predict the past in the deterministic scenario, right? So there is no really a preferred direction of time on the basic levels.
So
let me just
fighting into the.
Let me make one comment only. So the takeaway message from this is that at least the second branch of solutions that appears when you take any derivation of special relativity you want, should not be discarded just because it's so silly to take it into account. It appears that it is less silly than it appears. I mean, it turns out to be not as crazy as it looks first. And what I'm saying is that there is the well-known paradoxes, like grandfather paradox, have to be really re-examined, taking this into account. they may not be so that decisive and ultimate as they are presented.
Okay, so Rob, then.
Well, I just wondered, why doesn't this apply to sound? A fluid, phonons, speed of sound. I could carry out the same reasoning. I don't know what K is, so K could be the speed of sound in a fluid. So why doesn't this apply there? Which evidently it doesn't experimentally.
I have to think about it. Sorry, I'm...
Okay, think about it.
I need more than 30 seconds.
That's fine. Don't go. I don't want to bite into the coffee break.
Okay, so you're going to get back on that one, and then just that
so
last question.
Do you understand that superluminal observers were introduced just to argue that it must be probabilistic theory, and then there is this derivation that I can actually take without the first part of the story and say, what happens if I have probabilistic theory and I look for some relativistic
yes.
solutions? Okay, so this would be kind of a smaller, less assumptions, and maybe from the probabilistic theory, I will get to the quantum theory. Probabilistic theory plus this relativistic quantum theory,
yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah. I think the most interesting part is that if you take those observers, even potentially their possibility of existence into account, you end up in these schemes. And I'm not saying that superluminal observers have to physically exist, because this is not for special relativity to decide what observers exist, what don't. For instance, in relativity, there could be a particle that has half of the electron. Relativity allows you to consider any mass of the particle, including half of the electron. But in reality, there are no such particles. And it's not because of special relativity, but some other theories that are imposed on top of the special relativity. And for the same reason, special relativity, as I understand it, allows for superluminal particles and observers, which maybe don't exist because those particles don't exist for a reason that we don't understand yet, but it's not because of the special relativistic considerations.
How do you explain relativistic classical mechanics?
Well, it's in conflict with experiments, so you don't have to explain.
Okay, thank you very much.